You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on Presidential Election Day. Every 4 years, the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. And pleased to have on the program this morning from beautiful Danville, Kentucky, my good friend Martin Cothran. Martin, who blogs at the blog Vital Remnants. I put a link to it on the show's Facebook page as well as on the show's blog. He is policy analyst for the Family Foundation of Kentucky. He is an author and classical education advocate with Memoria Press, and oftentimes quoted on issues of public concern. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
So you're crediting the fallback weekend to your willingness to be on the show so early.
I'm directly relating the two.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of like, I mean, but if you're an NFL fan, this is sort of like Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, if you like politics, I mean, this is, you know, will you be watching, you know, cable news until the wee hours tonight?
Depending on what happens, we may not need to watch it that long.
Oh, you think it could possibly be wrapped up early?
Well, he's got to win Florida. Trump has to win Florida in order to make it competitive, and that's an East Coast state, so we'll tell that one early.
Unless we've got some hanging chads.
It's Florida way too often.
So you got Florida. Yeah, there's a I give out these What Were You Thinking awards every day, and I usually go over to FARC.com, which is kind of a fun website, but they have crazy stories of people doing idiotic things, and Florida has its own tab, its own category. So I guess that's true on election day, too.
If you remember Dave Barry, the great humor writer, writing about Miami in particular, there was a whole range of peculiar things that he talked about going on in Miami. And then, of course, in this election, they were talking last night. They were talking about Florida, and then they brought up Dade County, and I'm thinking, oh, no, this is the same place we parked for a while in the 2000 election. So.
That's when we got introduced to Kathleen Harris and, everything else.
Yes.
Anyway, well, let's talk for a minute about this election. And it's a particularly, I think, it proven to be a difficult one for a lot of people. Certainly, I think for Christians and particularly Catholics as well, where you've got, by everybody's estimate, there are a few people who will say we've really got two clearly morally upstanding persons who are running for office. In fact, the vast majority of people will acknowledge that. You know, this is a disappointing two candidates for us to have to choose from. But there are those, of course, who, whether it's because of their partisan loyalties or because they really, believe in there are a lot of people who are voting against another candidate, for example. But you put out a blog piece over the weekend, Why I Am Not Voting for Donald Trump. Now, I think there are a lot of people, we've talked about this before with you, Martin. You're such a public face. People have a caricature, I think, of you, that you are a Republican Party hack. As I've said, a 5-minute conversation with you would dispel that notion. You are conservative, but a conservative in the truest sense. But anyway, let's talk about this, your decision to make this public announcement that you're not voting for Donald Trump. Why did you think that was important to put out there?
Well, I could have put it, and I thought of putting in parentheses that the title wouldn't have been too long, or Trump either, just to make that clear.
You mean or Clinton either?
Or Clinton either. I think you know, the part of the problem with the Trump candidacy is that it has split conservatives. There will have been a lot of damage done in this whole election, no matter what happens, I think, because I think after Trump, the party is going to have to put itself back together again. I am a Republican because I am conservative, a conservative in the old Russell Kirk sense, who influenced was Russell Kirk who was responsible for the entire 20th century conservative movement, and he was a traditionalist conservative, not what we might call a neoconservative today. If we could get into that at some point, that's complicated. But really, I felt like I had to say something because this is a question I get asked all the time, and so I felt I had to say something about it. And the main argument I made was pushing back against a particular argument that I hear coming from Trump advocates that they're addressing to conservatives, which is, if you don't vote for Trump, that is in effect a vote in favor of Hillary. And I totally disagree with that argument, that because it is a form of what I would call consequentialist or utilitarian reasoning, that the rightness of your action is dependent upon its consequences. In other words, with John Stuart, the famous John Stuart Mill, the originator of what we call utilitarianism, he would say that your action should be the action that produces the greatest good of the greatest number. That is as modernist and secular form of reasoning as you will find. That goes very much against the whole idea of Catholic ethics, which is teleological. If you're made in the image of God, and your action is right or wrong in accordance with how well it corresponds to that nature and purpose in you. We're not consequentialists, and yet I hear a lot, even from Catholics, this consequentialist reasoning. And the problem with it is that we cannot control consequences. We're just supposed to do the right thing. The consequences are up to God. We're not supposed to do the wrong thing. Even if we have calculated that it will lead to the greatest good of the greatest number, we take consequences into account, but that's not what should form our decision.
No, that's a reasoning right out of Peter Singer's playbook, the utilitarian Princeton philosopher, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number.
Right.
You know, I think the thing that has bothered me here in this whole election, and I've been criticized for anybody who's paying attention to what I say, which is not a huge number, of course, but that, you know, I can't vote for either candidate. And I get told basically that if I'm not voting for Trump, then I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. And because she is, of course, a pro-abortion, the most pro-abortion candidate that we've known, I think, in terms of from a major party, with talking about repealing the Hyde Amendment and so forth. There are grave concerns about who she'll appoint to the Supreme Court and concerns about religious freedom and liberty, particularly around the issue of marriage. And so, you know, that I have blood on my hands because I'll make it possible for her to be elected. But as you're saying then, that it's really, we have to, it's not so much trying to think through all these various contingencies, but who is someone I can in good conscience cast my vote for? That's what it's been for me with Donald Trump. I can in good conscience cast a vote for someone who on so many levels, it's not just that he said bad things or dirty words or whatever. It's the whole approach he's taken, the fomenting of almost the worst aspects of American nativism, all these things.
Yes, well, I think that I think we have to allow for the possibility that there may be a slate of candidates in front of us, some better, some worse, but all of them unacceptable. I've used the admittedly extreme example of you know, if our choice is between voting for the devil and Hitler, are we obligated to vote for Hitler? No, we should not vote for either one of them. And the argument that the abortion issue in particular, but a number of issues that are affected by the Supreme Court, because really the strongest argument for Trump's candidacy is that he claims that he will nominate conservative justices who will vote against Roe versus Wade and this sort of thing. And I would love to believe that, but number one, he's very much a Johnny-come-lately on this issue. He has demonstrated a number of times through his comments he doesn't understand the issue. And I would love to believe that we could get any president into the Oval Office who would appoint a Scalia-like justice. But we've got to remember how soft my own party has been on this kind of mm-hmm. issue. The Democrats will get up there and they will use Roe versus Wade as a litmus test. If you don't support it, then we don't support you. Conservatives have never they haven't had the courage to say if you are supportive of Roe versus Wade, we're not voting for you. They won't oppose a justice who is a bad justice. Go look at the Stephen Breyer vote. One of the liberal justices on the court right now. Go look at how many conservatives voted for Stephen Breyer. I think he had 89 votes in support.
Mm.
These are conservatives. Go back and look at the Robert Bork fiasco.
Mark, we're up against a hard break, so we'll come back and revisit this on the other side of the break. Mike Allen here with my good friend Martin Cothran. We'll be back here on the Mike Allen Show. If you've got a question or a comment, 573-4-BREAD-4.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show, here with my good friend Martin Cothran, classical education author and advocate, policy analyst for the Family Foundation of Kentucky, and oft quoted on many social issues. We're talking about his blog, which you can check out, Vital Remnants. Google it up, Vital Remnants, where he holds forth on a number of issues, having an article over the weekend of saying why he certainly cannot vote for Hillary Clinton for president because of several issues. He certainly cannot vote for Donald Trump either. We were talking a little bit about the Supreme Court there, Martin, and I was talking off the air. You know, people, you know, Trump has said over and over, I'm going to put people like Justice Scalia. Listen, I don't believe for a minute that Donald Trump is any more familiar with the Constitution than most people are, to be quite honest with you. He talks about Scalia. He talks almost in these sort of terms like, I myself am going to repeal Roe v. Wade. But, you know, as I've contended before, if you ever hear interviews with Justice Scalia, his opinion as a justice on abortion was really neutral. He felt like the Constitution, and certainly as a Catholic, he was pro-life. But as a judge, he felt like the Constitution was actually noncommittal on the issue of abortion, and it was better suited in the democratic process. So the idea that Donald Trump is going to unilaterally end abortion in this country is ludicrous.
Well, and there have been a lot of grandiose promises made that are make for good campaign rhetoric, but it doesn't signify a great understanding of a lot of issues. I mean, his understanding of the abortion issue, you know, we saw how much he didn't understand the whole debate when he came out and was talking about punishing women for abortions, which has never been a position of pro-life movement, and he got swiftly slapped down on that by pro-life groups. I mean, it was just one indication of how little he really knows about the issue. And, you know, I'm just talking before, you know, because I would love to think that we could have a president who could nominate a conservative nominee, and that, you know, somebody like Scalia, and that we could get that to the Senate. But the problem is, even if he did that, we have a lot of Republican leaders who, quite frankly, wimp out on this on these kinds of debates. And even in the case of Robert Bork, who took the position you just described about Scalia, he felt that it was an issue that should be left up to the democratic processes of the states. When his nomination was turned down by the committee but sent to the floor, all of a sudden support for his supporters went silent, and this was the Reagan administration.
Right.
You know, if we can't even get the Reagan administration to stand up for conservative nominees, I don't know what we think we're going to be able to do on this. I unfortunately think that we're just in big, big trouble on the court. And the court has gone rogue from the Constitution, and it is violating the separation of powers by taking on legislative authority. And it is not operating in a legitimate way right now. And I think we've come to a point where we've got to ask ourselves what can be done about this. Because I really don't think that the people who are purporting to lead the conservative movement have the toughness to fight this battle. I'd love to think that they did. And if Donald Trump gets in, I hope he does do what he says he's going to do. But I have my doubts about whether our whole movement is going to really step up on this. And again, we can't know. We can try to predict the consequences, but we don't know what the consequences are. Again, we're supposed to vote for the right person, and we've got a candidate in front of us who's got very serious character issues, and we've got to ask ourselves, is this going to be our poster boy? For 4 years, he's going to be the guy who's going to speak for you. I think he's not a very good spokesperson for our position, and he's going to embarrass us again and again and again.
We have to take a longer view, don't we, Martin? I mean, on the impact of this election on the pro-life viewpoint, because my thought is that we lose a ton of credibility with those who may be persuadable when we just appear to be partisan hacks.
Right. And I think in this election, what we are facing is, we could recast this as a choice between two people, both of whom are going to embarrass their followers when they get into office. And one of the questions I had to ask myself was, do I want somebody in office who's going to embarrass the secular liberals, or who embarrasses me? And I quite frankly don't want to be embarrassed for 4 years.
I see, according to your article, you say you're going to vote for the same person you voted in the primary, Carly Fiorina. What about those who argue, you know, if you vote for somebody who has no chance to win, you're wasting your vote?
Well, this is the problem. One of the things I pointed out about consequentialism is if everybody votes using consequentialist reasoning, that has the worst consequences. Yeah, even by their own standards, it doesn't work, because it's the kind of argumentation we hear as in my own party, Republicans, that we hear every primary season. We are told you need to vote for the candidate who has the best chance of winning. That will produce the best consequences for us. And so we inevitably produce a candidate who is not, by using that reasoning, we produce a candidate who is not the person most likely to win. And so if everyone would just do the right thing, which is to vote for not only the best candidate, but one who can be a good president. If we all just did that, everything would be much better off than it is now. If we could feel free of this consequentialist reasoning to vote for candidates in the primary who really were the best candidates, and forget about who we think is going to, has the most chance of winning, because we're often wrong on that. It's proved over and over again.
Let's talk about your the blog post you put up yesterday. Here in the last 4 minutes or so we've got together. The question is not whether Trump, your headline says, is not whether Trump will accept tomorrow's election results, or I guess we'd say today's, but whether the rest of us will. That's a concern that I have. I whether it's rioters, if Trump wins, torching cities and neighborhoods, or whether it's militia, if Clinton wins, emboldened by Trump. I mean, it's a little unnerving.
Yeah, I was making that remark in the wake of that whole discussion that we seemed to have for about a week, which seemed to me a pretty absurd discussion. And Anderson Cooper brought this up last night on CNN, that, you know, well, what happens? What if Trump doesn't accept the results of this election? Then it doesn't matter. Is he going to hold up the whole election process by not agreeing? That's Trump's problem.
Yeah,
not our problem. Yeah, but I think that the more important question is, you know, what is this going to do to the country? Because whoever wins, there's going to be some very, very dissatisfied people, no matter which way it goes. And I just think both candidates are so unacceptable that it's going to be hard for one side or the other. And I'd rather... I think that whoever gets elected is going to be a one-term president, and because they're neither one's going to make a very good president. And so this is what I meant about the long-term and the short-term. If we look at this in the light of the long-term, we need to be concerned about where we're going to be in 4 years. Mm. Are we going to be better off in 4 years than we are now by electing Trump? Because I think that that's a one-term presidency, and we need to stop looking at what's right in front of us and look at the long term on this. Because I don't think the long term is good under a Trump presidency.
You know, we've kind of lived through. You know, we had 8 years of President Bush, and there was a term that was coined during those years of Bush derangement syndrome, right, to where nothing the man could do, according to some. I mean, he was vilified for every choice that he made. Then we flip that around, and I think in some ways we've had 8 years of Obama derangement syndrome. And I've been sort of critical of the conservatives who I think sound shrill on every single thing the president ever does, and therefore they lose any sort of traction on the issues that should be criticized. Do you think that has, I can only imagine how that's going to be magnified in the next 4 years.
Right. Well, and if we can name names, Sean Hannity.
Yeah.
I came up with a way for determining who won the debates. All I did was after the debate, I would go and see how Anderson Cooper or Don Lemon or Jake Tapper was feeling in CNN. And then I turned the channel and see how Sean Hannity was feeling after the debate on Fox News. And if Hannity was feeling good and Cooper et al. Were looking pretty sad, then I knew that Trump won the debate. If I go over to CNN and Anderson and these guys are looking great and Sean Hannity is not looking good, then I know that Hillary won the debate. That's my way of figuring out who won. Because they're both so utterly blindly partisan.
It's like accounting for wind on your golf swing, I guess, the same sort of thing. Listen, Martin, we're out of time. Thanks for being with us. Blessings to you today and to you and your family.
You too, Mike.
All right. We'll be back with the Bishop. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Selection Day, Tuesday, November 8th. Blessed to have with us via phone Bishop John Stowe of the Diocese of Lexington, Kentucky. He's the third Bishop of Lexington, ordained and installed on Cinco de Mayo just about a year and a half ago. Bishop John is, as I said, part of the Franciscan Order, a conventual, and we're pleased to have him with us. Bishop John, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
I want to talk about an article you wrote in the Diocesan newspaper a few weeks ago, Crossroads, which you begin with these words. This is a column I didn't want to write. And you talked about really our role as faithful citizens in a republic like ours and our responsibility in the voting booth. Why is this an issue you did not want to write about?
Well, I didn't want to write about it because it's walking a very thin line. You know, the church is supposed to be forming consciences, and that late in the political season, it's very hard to form consciences when opinions have been formed far in advance of consciences. We've been the victims of a lot of ugly rhetoric on both sides. I would say one side much uglier and fiercer than the other side, but we're trying to maintain a nonpartisan stance and teach about issues, but the candidates certainly get all the attention, and rightly so, because when you go into the voting booth, you have to vote for a candidate. So it was a column I didn't want to write because I know that our own people are very divided, and you can't say anything to please everybody, and I try to focus on gospel teachings. I think that's what my role is, and gospel teachings probably wouldn't win any elections in our country. That's the sad reality.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about the Johnson Amendment in this election, you know, and I think Donald Trump has talked about repealing it, which is, I guess, an amendment that keeps religious institutions from and clergy from endorsing political candidates as a threat, really, to their tax-exempt status. I'm of the opinion that the Johnson Amendment is probably a good thing. I think it's counterproductive to have endorsements. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, especially for the Catholic Church, you know, we really focus on our Catholicism, our universality, our call to bring people together. And there's a lot of applications of our church's teaching that we can have legitimate differences about. And in a democratic form of government, in a democracy, you know, we should be able to bring solid, reasonable arguments to the table and be able to differ about those. Our motivations should be rooted in the gospel, the teachings of Christ, and the teachings of our church, and how we apply those can be different. So to take a partisan stand and put all of our eggs in one basket, or to be out, you know, vocally in favor of one candidate, you know, risks alienation of a large number of the faithful and risks the credibility of a church leader. So I would hate to see the church get engaged in the partisan politics. It's hard not to. At the same time, there's a good reason why we keep the focus on issues rather than on persons or parties.
I guess too, as someone whose role is an ordained minister is to, you know, to serve and minister to the people, you can really risk hamstringing your credibility and alienating, you know, half your congregants in a bitterly divided election.
That's exactly right. And no matter who wins, we have to work with that person, and we also have to resist things that are contrary to our faith. I mean, we're going to be pro-life tomorrow. We're going to be pro-life, you know, forever. That's part of who we are. And pro-life is much broader than just anti-abortion, although the abortion issue is central to who we are as well. I mean, if we don't consider life sacred from the womb, then we have a problem from the beginning. But then you get into the issues of what branch of government is really responsible for changing that law. How does it come about? We've had, you know, decades of pro-life presidents, and there's been no change in the Roe versus Wade issue from 1973. So, you know, that becomes an issue that's central in the presidential election, but it's not the only issue. And I'm afraid that people who think they're pro-life and focus exclusively on one issue are missing a bigger picture of what the church teaches.
You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the fullness of Catholic moral teaching would probably not win an election in the United States. Do you think, you know, there have been some who've argued that if any good comes out of this in this election cycle, it's that the pretense has finally been stripped away from the idea that there is one party that fully represents Catholic teaching, that that this has maybe always been the case. It's just become more clear in this election.
It's always been the case, but I'm horrified by people that continue to think that one party does represent church teaching based on a single issue.
Yeah,
and would label other Catholics as being unfaithful, as being heretical. I mean, the language has been hideous. It's almost as ugly as the candidate's language. So, talking about fellow Catholics.
Oh yeah, it's been unbelievable and very, very, very divisive. So for a person, let's say, because I think you said you'd already been to the voting booth. Is that right?
Just came back. Yes, 40 minutes in line.
How were the lines? You said a good line.
Yeah, 40 minutes I stood in line, so it's a good line.
Wow. So what, for those who have not yet been to the polls, a Catholic, right? Someone who is seeking to discern, they look at the candidates that are there, they've got decisions to make, whether it's to vote for one of the two major party candidates, whether to abstain from voting for the presidential race and vote later down the ticket, or to vote for maybe a write-in, a third party. What principles should guide them?
Well, as I said earlier, it's pretty late to be forming consciences, but it's our conscience that should guide us, not our opinions or not our party affiliation. And we have to vote for what we think is the best in the best candidate. And, you know, there's going to be inevitably either side of the major parties or the minor parties, there's always going to be something you're disagreeing with on that ticket. We have to go by the best that we can offer in the larger picture. And we have to look, when we're talking about a candidate, we seriously have to look at their qualifications for office. And we cannot take lightly the fact that we're voting for the leader of the free world. And this is a very serious obligation. I can understand people who think in good conscience that they can't vote for either party. Then we certainly have to, or any of the candidates, then we certainly have to take seriously the other leaders down the line. We can't just abdicate our responsibility to vote in a participatory democracy.
You know, one of the issues I've been disappointed that hasn't gotten more discussion in this election is the immigration issue. Because, I mean, we still have this just untenable situation with so many who are living in the shadows. And, you know, have you been disappointed that issue hasn't gotten more traction, except maybe on one side where it's been almost
really
jingoistic?
Ugly, divisive kind of attention, and nobody's putting forth good solutions, although, the Democratic candidate says that she will work for comprehensive immigration reform. We've heard that before, and I certainly hope it is the case that we can work for that kind of reform. You know, the Catholic Church has advocated, yes, nations have a right to control their borders. Nobody, in the Church is advocating for open borders. That's a false characterization. But the fact is the system is broken, and we need the labor that's provided by immigrant workers. And we also have to provide a safe place for people who are literally running away from starvation, from the danger of violence, gangs, drugs. There's a good reason people come here to provide for their families. And the vast, vast majority of those who are coming into our country to provide for their families, live by the values that we would really want to embrace as a nation and to make us stronger. They work hard. They care for their families. They're people of faith. And I think it would, it strengthens our country. That's been our history from the beginning.
Bishop, another topic, one of the things that sort of blew up on Catholic social media yesterday was the Father Frank Pavone with Priests for Life did a Facebook Live video where he had the naked body of an aborted child intact, but on a sacred altar. He stood behind it, making a last-minute plea, what he termed, I guess, a wake-up call to vote for who he views as the pro-life candidate, Donald Trump. Your thoughts as a bishop seeing a priest do something like that?
I think that is shameless, and I think it is reprehensible. I think that is exploiting the feelings of people. It is exploiting a critical issue for our future as a people. Yes, we are pro-life, and yes, we're anti-abortion, but by what church standard does one take the sacred body of an aborted fetus and use it as a prop for your political agenda? And since when do we give in so wholeheartedly to one party, especially when the person who represents that party has a horrendous record, even including his earlier support of abortion and Planned Parenthood all of his public life?
It's a, he has a bishop, of course. I guess as a bishop, you have to make those decisions. And when you have someone in clergy who's a public person and their responsibility under your authority.
Well, he's had difficulty with bishops before, and recently things were cleared up, I thought, and he put forth an attitude that he would be obedient and comply with a responsible direction from his legitimate superior. But he's also got a national forum. He's got a huge movement, and, as somebody who is clearly pro-life, I would love to support what he's doing. I'd love to be part of a group called Priests for Life, but I don't trust his integrity in the least, and he's demonstrated it very clearly this week.
Bishop, we've got about 40 seconds left. Would you give us your blessing and thanks again for your leadership?
Well, let's ask God's blessing upon our nation, and whatever happens today, we have to continue forward, and as people of faith, we've got to be strong people of faith no matter who wins, and continue to vote for our party, which is the gospel, which is the teachings of Christ. So may Almighty God bless you and all the listeners, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Bishop John. Safe travels today, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back in a minute with more. If you've got a question or a comment, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Election Day. Finally. Let's hope that there are no hanging chads and this thing is decided before we go to bed tonight. I don't know if this country can handle it. Anyway, my question is, if you could unilaterally appoint someone to be president of the United States, you had that authority and they were qualified and able to do it, and you could do that. Who would you pick? 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. You can also comment on Facebook or on Twitter. Let's see. Allison says Christian Bale. He is Batman. Very good. Of course, there have been several Batmen. Is that how you'd say it? Allison, I guess it would be Batmans. I mean, Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, and so forth. But she's a Christian Bale fan, obviously. Alex, our own Alex, chimes in. John Calipari. So he's been a pioneer for the new era of college basketball. In other words, he made Kentucky basketball great again, right? And the often criticized one-and-done rule. He has single-handedly made the rule his own and promises kids the best of the NBA, best pass to the NBA, and he delivers. Wow. So then he goes on and extols all the various qualifications of John Calipari. I could live with that. I'd pick him over the two candidates we've got. Other three candidates I would consider Bill Murray, Matthew McConaughey. Now, that'd be interesting. The only thing I want to say about our economy is it's all right, all right, all right. And then he also going with Christian Bale, same nominee his sister put forth. Siblings stick together. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 573, you can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Wow, what a great hour to have Martin Cothran, one of the clearest thinkers I know, and then to have Bishop John Stowe, who's the bishop here in Lexington where we broadcast from, my bishop. And I want to post a link to the version of, I don't know if I can form post a link to this article that he wrote. Let me read just a little bit of it. This was the one he wrote in our diocesan newspaper. He said, "I cannot endorse a candidate," Bishop John said. "The church does not tell people for which person they should vote. We teach issues that are important, not just to people who share our beliefs, but issues that promote the common good and take the most vulnerable into consideration. We try to apply the gospel to civic life. And as participants in a democracy, we argue that our voice should be heard in the public square, not in favor or against a political party or a particular candidate. Yeah, I mean, that's part of, in my opinion, why we have no business with clergy endorsing individual candidates. He said, the U.S. bishops describe our role in the political sphere as one of forming consciences for faithful citizenship. That's really a document well worth reading. He said, a month away from a major election is too late to begin forming consciences. But here's what he has to say. He said, my mailbox has been flooded lately with very sincere but often nasty letters about the need for the church to be more vocal on pro-life issues in the election. The problem with the content of this mail is that it is more anti-abortion than it is pro-life. I do not see the preservation of the environment or the interrelationship of all life as articulated so well in Laudato Si as a value to be brought to the ballot box. It does not see that racism and discrimination against groups of people based on ethnicity or religion are not pro-life positions. Is it really pro-life to consider the Second Amendment as an absolute good, regardless of how many lives are tragically ended? Is it pro-life to promote policies that cut social services that assist families headed by the working poor in order to make more wealth for the most wealthy? So we really need a full vision and understanding of what it means to be a pro-life person in all of its dynamics. And he does not in any way welsh or back down from the absolute insistence of the inviolability of unborn human life and what a travesty of justice that it is that their lives are legally taken and in our current situation and by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, every year. So we, as he said, the time to form consciences for faithful citizenship begins again the day after the polls close, when we will still have to advocate for the poor, for the immigrant and the stranger, for the unborn, for the workers' fair wages, for the protection of the environment, for fair treatment of people of all races, ethnicities, religions, and lifestyles, for making peace, for freedom of conscience, and for the values that we profess Sunday after Sunday. May God help us to be faithful citizens and promote His kingdom above all. Good word indeed. Let's get off the election for just a minute. I know you'll be glad to do that. It was an interesting piece. There's a blog I go to sometimes called A Cup of Joe. It's done by Joanna Goddard. Joanna Goddard, who I'm sure probably is votes differently than me on a lot of issues. But it's always interesting to see her perspective on things as a sort of modern professional mother, wife, and feminist, and very active in her career. She has a piece up on motherhood, going from one kids to two kids. She said, one of the biggest questions we get asked by readers with kids is, what's it like going from one child to two? Now, I have to admit, as someone, and we've certainly been blessed, but as someone blessed with seven children, it's hard for me to go back and imagine what it was like to go from one to two. I can if I dust it off, but, you know, sometimes people ask, what's it like to have seven children? How can you, you know, we have a hard time handling our one or two. How can you handle seven? Everything's relative, and you just kind of, you know, you reach a certain point as a parent of a large family where you give up the illusion. You know, we talked about how this election is, it is an opportunity to give up the illusion that we have a political party that fully represents Catholic teaching. Maybe it's the thing about parenting a large family. You give up the illusion of control. You just go ahead and embrace the chaos. But as I say to people, and maybe there's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think the transition of going from zero to one child is actually more significant than the transition of going from one to seven. Because parenthood is a sort of, it's its own thing. It's what sui generis in the Latin, right? It's just entering into the state of parenthood, no matter how many, reorients one's interests and priorities and surfaces, as it always does, our own selfishness and self-interest. But it's an interesting piece, and I'll post a link to it on the show's Facebook page where she goes on to talk about it. I was actually happy to see it because she talks very positively about their experience of going from one child to a second. You know, she, of course, is very respectful of people and the decisions that they make. But I would say I would extend the same reality and going from two to even more, because we kind of live in an age and in a world where, honestly, any more than two, people begin to look at you a little bit askance. Some friends with four, they were saying over the weekend on our marriage prep retreat that, you know, as parents of four, they got comments all the time and get comments all the time. You know, you all need to get a hobby, or you need to watch TV, or whatever. But it's really a very positive article about going from one to two. And I'm wondering if you know, maybe it's the former geometry teacher in me, but if you had this graph where you had number of children on the bottom and you had increased difficulty of family life on the vertical column. So horizontal number of children, vertical is increased difficulty. I would have to imagine that the farther you go to the right on that axis, the larger the number of children. Certainly the slope of the line continues to be positive. I mean, it's harder to have eight than it is to have five. But how much, I wonder, how much does that slope begin to, is there ever a point where that slope becomes zero? In other words, where that line becomes flat? You know, is there a huge difference between having 14 children and having 15 children? Hard for me to imagine. So interesting. Like I said, though, I think a very positive article about parenthood. And I would say, you know, the word I hate to hear sometimes from people is we're done. D-O-N-E, done. Cultivate that generosity of spirit that you never know what God may have in store for you. Let's go to random.org, our random number generator, and let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel here on Election Day. We've got about a minute left. Wow, paragraph 5 out of this great repository of the Catholic faith. Randomly choosing, even though we know truth is never random. Catechesis. This is on handing on the faith. Catechesis, by the way, a word at its root means echo. Catechesis is an education in the faith of children, young people, and adults, which includes especially the teaching of Christian doctrine imparted, generally speaking, in an organic and systematic way, with a view to initiating the hearers into the fullness of Christian life. An education in the faith. That word education, I think, means to draw out. So we recognize the thirst for truth that is in every human person, and we seek to direct that thirst to its proper end. And that is the beauty and the richness of the faith. Organic and systematic. That's the beautiful thing. And you'll find that in the Catechism, the wonderful interconnectedness of all the truths that we espouse. And it's those truths you and I should carry into the voter booth today. Vote your conscience. Vote as a citizen. The sun will still come up, God willing, tomorrow. And I'll be with you then. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.